Welcome to Whitley on Wine with your host, nationally syndicated wine columnist Robert Whitley.
Peel me a grape, crush me some ice, skin me a peach, save the fuzz for my pillow. Talk to me nice, talk to me nice, you've got to wine me. Don't try to fool me, bejewel me, either amuse me or lose me. I'm getting hungry, peel me a grape.
Welcome to another week of Whitley on Wine, and I just popped a piece of chocolate in my mouth in celebration of the upcoming Valentine's Day. We're going to do a winemaker interview today, and my guest is Steve Fennell, the winemaker and general manager of Sanford Winery in Santa Barbara County. Welcome.
Thank you, Robert.
You know, you're up there in sideways country, and you specialize in Pinot Noir, but you didn't start out in Santa Barbara. You started out in Napa. And I guess my first question is, because you have a really interesting background, tell me the story of going to Napa and then leaving.
Sure. In some ways, I actually started in Santa Barbara, but that was before my adventures in wine. I actually did my undergraduate education at UC Santa Barbara. I studied geology and geography. So that was really where I sort of first got the wine bug. And then by the time I graduated, I was pretty sure I wanted to pursue my interest and my passion for wine. And being interested in science and also in agriculture, it seemed like a pretty logical thing to follow. So then I went to UC Davis for graduate school and studied enology, and then worked in Napa, which was a mecca for fine wine and a great place to learn. And I enjoyed all the time in Napa, and I learned a tremendous amount. But I was extremely excited to be able to come back down to Santa Barbara and to grow grapes and make wine in a region that, you know, I think is really, really exciting. And, you know, I think we're seeing quality improvements on a yearly basis. So it was...
How did you take, an interest in wine, a fan's interest in wine, wine enthusiast's interest in wine, and extrapolate that into a career in wine? I mean, how did that evolve? Because lots of us really enjoy wine. We become wine collectors. We enjoy visiting wine country, but we never think that we would want to be a winemaker.
Sure. I think for me, it was really a combination of my interests. And, you know, I had always been interested in science, and having studied science at the university level, you know, I knew that I had the basic background in chemistry and biology to really go in the direction of winemaking. And I also actually had some experience in agriculture. My summer job was in agriculture. I worked for H.J. Heinz, their ag research division, improving ketchup. I found wine much more interesting than ketchup, but it was certainly a good training for agriculture in general in the ways of applying science to agriculture. And then when I really got the wine bug, it was kind of a Shazam moment where I realized that I could take all of these interests and apply my passion and get paid for it. So it would just seem like the best possibility for a career. And then before going to UC Davis, I took a winemaking class at a junior college, and that was taught by a grape grower and winemaker. And I really wanted to kind of ferret out to see if my interest was significant enough to kind of get me through the hurdles, and over the hurdles. And it definitely seemed like the more I learned about it, the more excited I got. So, you know, I think for me, it was really pretty quickly it became such an obvious choice. And to be honest, I really cannot see myself doing anything else.
Now, when you came out of Davis, you ended up in the Napa Valley. Excuse me. And as I said, and you just sort of reaffirmed that, it is sort of the mecca for wine in the United States. I would have to think the entire United States, although there might be some people who say, no, I would rather be in Oregon. And that's fine. You know, Oregon's a pretty cool place. And you're obviously down in Santa Barbara County now, and that's a pretty cool place. But Napa Valley has a certain prestige level and cachet and whatnot. So you're fresh out of UC Davis, and you're chomping at the bit to go to work, and you end up being lucky enough to get a job in the Napa Valley. How did that happen, and where did you first work, and what was the progress of your career?
Sure. I had the opportunity while going to UC Davis to do an internship at Trefethen Vineyards, where they each year they bring on a couple of students, usually two or three, mm-hmm. very often from UC Davis. My first experience there, I worked for 6 months from June until December. So I got, you know, certainly the harvest, but also, you know, a good part of the winemaking cycle. And that was a fantastic opportunity, my first real winemaking experience. And then I went back to school. And then the following harvest, I was actually hired again at Trefethen, sort of as a super intern, because they had actually lost a cellar worker, and they really needed some experience. Mm-hmm. But you know, they weren't looking to add a full time person, so it worked really well for me. So I got more, you know, again, more winemaking experience. And then when I was finishing up school, I guess I had done a good enough job there, and they liked me, and I liked them. They offered me initially an enologist position at Trefethen. So I felt very fortunate to have a job waiting for me. And before I started, I was actually promoted because the assistant winemaker was leaving. So I got to start as both the enologist and the assistant winemaker, which was a tremendous amount of work. But you know, I think I really accelerated my learning in that process. Mm-hmm. And then after about 6 months, we hired an enologist. So
you know, I'd like to know what your definition of the difference, and I imagine it varies from winery to winery, the difference between the enologist position and a winemaker, assistant winemaker. If you're, let's say, at Trefethen and you're the enologist, are you basically just dealing with lab samples and looking at the chemistry of things and making sure everything's what it's supposed to be, and you're not really involved in the decision-making that a winemaker would have to go through in terms of barrels and picking and that sort of stuff?
Yeah, in general terms, that's definitely true. At Trefethen, it was such a good collaborative working environment with the winemaker, the assistant winemaker, mm-hmm. and the enologist. So there was involvement in terms of tasting, you know, basically tasting, you know, during harvest and for blends and even final, you know, pre-bottling and even post-bottling tastings. You know, there was a lot of interaction and sharing of ideas. But in terms of the decision making and the style, it's much more falls on the shoulders of the winemaker.
The winemaker.
Where exactly as you say, the enologist, the chief responsibility is more the science end of it. It's sort of, in some ways, it's sort of a quality assurance. Mm-hmm. Quality control kind of role.
And, you know, for those who don't know, although Trefethen has been around for more than 30 years and is certainly widely distributed and very well known, but they specialize in really wonderful Cabernets and beautiful Chardonnay, and they make a really nice Riesling.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's one of those sort of iconic mm-hmm. Napa Valley brands. And besides just being a good learning and training ground for winemaking in general, I developed my interest in vineyards. I was involved in the vineyard side as well, which really helped. I think it's continued to help me in my career.
And how long ago was this?
I left in 1999. So okay. I worked there from 94 to 99.
So after work every day, you got in the car, you went down Highway 29, you pulled into Bistro Don Giovanni, you sat at the bar, you had a pizza and a glass of wine.
Yeah.
That's what I would do if I worked there.
Yeah, not every day, but very often.
I like the location, and I like Bistro Don Giovanni, so and Trefethen's not too far away. So where did you go from Trefethen?
I went from Trefethen to a little Australian-owned outfit called Voss Vineyards, mm-hmm. which has a little vineyard in Rutherford, growing primarily Sauvignon Blanc, or we did Syrah and Viognier also. So it was really an interesting change, and I felt that it was a logical step in my career for several reasons. One was it was a much smaller operation, and I was really responsible for everything. I managed a 45-acre vineyard, and I was pretty much in charge of the entire production. So it was an opportunity to really increase my level of understanding of the entire business, including even the sales side.
And how old were you at the time? You had to be in your 20s.
I was late 20s. So I was at Voss from 1999 until 2006.
Mm-hmm.
I felt that I was ready again for another change. Although I was extremely happy doing what I was doing, but then the opportunity to come down to Sanford in Santa Barbara County.
I love it. The opportunity to leave the Napa Valley. Anyway, I thought that was interesting when I was looking at your bio that you started in the Napa Valley, which is, I mean, quite a feather in a young aspiring winemaker's cap, I would have to believe. And so you end up leaving, but you ended up going to Sanford, which is, you talk about iconic wineries. Richard Sanford, who started Sanford more than 30 years ago, was one of the great pioneers of Pinot Noir in Santa Barbara County. So you were going to a pretty good spot. But how did all that come about?
Well, it came about. I think they were interested in making some changes. As you know, that the partnership evolved, and Richard Sanford was no longer involved with the Sanford winery operation. So they wanted to make a few changes, winemaking changes and management changes. So I was contacted initially by Doug Fletcher, who was their vice president in charge of winemaking,
And the winemaker at Chimney Rock, and
exactly,
he does a
exactly.
few other projects for Tony Trilotto, and very well respected winemaker in the profession.
Absolutely, and he contacted me, so I began a conversation about this role, and after several meetings and discussing really what we thought the opportunities were, it was really very appealing, as our vision for the winery was really in line. I mean, we saw very much eye to eye in what we thought the potential could be. So then the Trilotto family was generous enough to take a chance on me. It was certainly a change, because things had been pretty static there for quite a while, and they were undergoing changes. So they felt I was right for the job, and
Did you have any hesitation at all about leaving the Napa Valley? Career-wise, I mean, just thinking, looking down the road 10 or 15 or 20 years.
Not really. And the reason is really twofold. One being, I'm such a fan of Santa Barbara, the city and the county. It's just such a wonderful place that I'm...
Were you raised outside of Santa Barbara, or...?
I was. I grew up in the Central Valley.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Stockton, California.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So when you saw the ocean, you fell in love.
Yeah, I did. I'm a big outdoor sports enthusiast, and Santa Barbara's just
And that campus at UCSB is pretty spectacular, because it's right up on the cliffs of the ocean and everything. Yeah.
Okay. It is.
I can see where you would fall in love with it.
So, the location was so appealing. But then beyond that, I just feel that for both Chardonnay and Pinot Noir, which is really what we do at Sanford, the potential, especially in the Santa Rita Hills, the western portion of the growing area, is really second to none. And I think, as good as the wines are and have been for some time, I firmly believe that they can be significantly better than they are now. And I think it's taken a movie like Sideways to really give
Pinot Noir
credibility,
a big
both
push.
Pinot Noir and just the area to some respect. And I think that I felt really, really excited to be part of some of those changes. And I think vintage by vintage, I think we at Sanford and many of our neighbors are continuing to make better and better wines.
Mm-hmm. Now, you had not worked with Pinot Noir before Sanford, right?
In a very small way at Trefethen.
Mm-hmm.
They did you know, we actually grew quite a bit of Pinot Noir. Most of it was sold for sparkling, but we had started towards the end of my career there actually producing some table wine. So it was...
Well, you know, my... first of all, my wine column goes back almost 20 years, and my interest in wine goes back much further than that. But, you know, for years you would hear winemakers say how difficult the Pinot Noir grape was to work with. And I think that's probably true, but also there was a, you know, 25 years ago in California, there weren't very many successful Pinot Noirs. And so how has that changed? Do you feel that it's a very challenging grape, or do you feel that the viticulture and the understanding of how to make good Pinot Noir has evolved to the point where, you know, you can be a little more comfortable about what you're doing with it?
Well, I think the answer to both of those is yes. I do think it's a challenging grape, both to grow well and to make well. It's certainly delicate. I think it's prone to overexposure to the sun, sunburn, dehydration. In a winemaking sense, it's certainly prone to oxidation and prone to overextraction. If you treat it as you would a bigger red wine like Cabernet, it's a recipe for disaster. You tend to make just really dry, tannic, not very interesting red wine, sort of a generic red wine. And I think that we have learned quite a bit, and much of it is sort of going back to some of the old world techniques, where certainly in Burgundy, where they've been working with this for hundreds of years, it had a bit of a head start. So I do think it's challenging, but I think that sometimes a little too much is made of that, of it being, you know.
Well, you know, I'll throw one thing out at you. You're in a very cool area. And I don't mean cool like hip. I mean cool like it's chilly. You know that. And one of the things I've noticed about some of the Pinots from the Santa Rita Hills, but I haven't picked it up in the Sanford. I think the Sanfords are very well made, and I really love those wines. And it's a pleasure to have you on the show. But I think one of the things that I see is wines that have beautiful aromatics, wonderful color, but that sort of green, bitter, tannic, seed tannin on the back end. And is that what you would consider one of the real challenges of the grape? Because you to make a nice, elegant Pinot Noir, you have to grow it in a cool environment, but you run the risk of having that sort of effect on the finished wine.
I do think it's one of the challenges, and one of the characteristics we see with Pinot Noir grapes is that those seeds don't tend to fully ripen until the fruit is extremely ripe, sometimes overripe. So what we try to do is to get everything as uniform in the vineyard as possible through our just basic canopy management. I mean, everything from pruning to canopy management to shoot thinning and then fruit thinning, to really try to even out the crop, to try to minimize the underripe green tannin that you get from the seeds. The other thing we do is, you know, we try to get a lot of extraction from the grapes early on in the fermentation, where we're doing, you know, punch downs as much as four times per day, but very early on. And then, as you know, well before dryness, we'll back that off and then actually stop, completely discontinue punching down before dryness. And then we drain and press usually right at dryness or shortly after. So it's not... it doesn't really have the opportunity to, with the presence of alcohol, to really extract a lot of those harsh tannins.
The bitterness, sure.
Exactly. So we're really trying to make, you know, big, plush, you know, vibrant Pinot Noir, but without that dry edge.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's talk a little bit about Chardonnay and also Sauvignon Blanc, which Sanford over the years has been very highly regarded for. Both. And they always had a very distinctive Sauvignon Blanc. It was a little grassy, but then they lost the vineyard source and it changed a little bit. And then the Chardonnay, I imagine, has to be very different for you from the Chardonnay you worked with at Trefethen. And Trefethen is very well known for Chardonnay. So what are some of the adjustments you had to make when you went to Santa Barbara County in terms of the difference of the fruit that you were working with and, you know, the length of the growing season and that sort of thing?
Sure. Well, with the length of the growing season, it's actually really, really remarkable in Santa Rita in particular. It's such a cool cool climate, temperature-wise, of course, that we have a very, very long growing season. You know, we typically get bud break in early March, and it's common that we'll still be picking Chardonnay well into October, sometimes mm-hmm. the end of October. So it's an extremely long growing season, and it enables the fruit to fully develop interesting aromatics, and usually a pretty good palate weight as well. And I think one thing that's very different about Santa Barbara County Chardonnay is the fruit character tends to be more tropical, you know, from crushed pineapple to sometimes even banana. Mm-hmm. You know, it's pretty exotic flavors, whereas I find in, you know, most of the North Coast is a little more apple, pear.
Parrot apple and lemon, yep.
Right, but, you know, a little bit more straightforward, where we just have these, you know, really exotic tropical fruit flavors. And then with Santa Rita, there's a mineral component, sort of a kind of a flinty or chalky character that I think really makes them interesting as well. And they sort of go a little bit more in the Burgundy direction. So I find that when you have a combination of those two, they can really make some remarkable wines. And, you know, what we really try to do with the Chardonnay is similar to the Pinot, which is, you know, to get, you know, a good extraction of flavor, but really try to be very conscious of not having any hard edges, be it from acid or phenolics. So with the Chardonnay, we whole cluster press, where we make sure that, you know, we don't you know, crush any seeds or do anything that's going to, you know, lead to some of those dry characteristics. So we look for, you know, just big fruit and a rich body, and then it's barrel fermented with, you know, a careful use of new oak, all French, but we don't really want the wines to be overbearing in oak character, so we look for, you know, just a balance of oak.
My impression is when I smell the your Chardonnay is that you know that there's oak there, but it's not the dominant presence. It's, you know, the fruit and the minerality.
Thank you. That's certainly what we try to do. Mm-hmm. And then we just do some very traditional Burgundian techniques of stirring the lees every 2 weeks for the first half of the barrel aging, which helps reduce oxidation. And during malolactic, because the wines are 100% malolactic, it really absorbs that buttery character. We really don't want overt butter in the Chardonnay. We like the creaminess and the natural deacidification that malolactic performs, but we really don't like it to
tastes like buttered popcorn.
Exactly, mm-hmm. And I think, unfortunately, for many people, that's kind of become what they think of as Chardonnay.
Yeah,
and that's not what we think of as Chardonnay. Mm-hmm. You know, in many ways, our example is still, you know, great white Burgundy, and, you know, we're very different and much more fruit-driven and tropical in character, but we love some of those elements of the minerality, the, you know, the good acidity, the structure, and the balance. I mean, I think for white and red, Chardonnay and Pinot, mm-hmm. you know, it really comes down to balance, and those are the wines that I appreciate most in what we're trying to do.
Now, we have about 3.5 minutes left, and I happen to love Sauvignon Blanc. And that was one of your big successes in the Napa Valley. How have you changed the Sanford Sauvignon Blanc, and can you make some comparisons?
Sure. I think, as you alluded to with the fruit sourcing, that was a big change. The Sanford Sauvignon Blanc, I think, had been sourced primarily from the Sisquoc area close to Santa Maria, where it's quite cool. It's really more of a Chardonnay and even Pinot Noir area. And the Sauvignon Blanc tended to go in the very sort of vegetal, sometimes even kind of a jalapeno direction.
Mm-hmm.
At one point, it was a large item for Sanford Winery, and it was widely distributed, and it was, you know, one of their major bottlings. Now we now source Sauvignon Blanc from the east end of the San Ynez Valley, from the Happy Canyon area, where it's quite a bit warmer.
A lot warmer, sure.
You know, it's an area that grows good Cabernet Sauvignon, Merlot, Cabernet Franc, and Syrah, and Viognier, actually. But the Sauvignon Blanc from there tends to be a little bit more like Napa Sauvignon Blanc, where, you know, there's a slight vegetal component, which is just part of the grape,
mm-hmm.
but it tends to be more racy grapefruit and sometimes, you know, passion fruit and that sort of thing, which I really like in Sauvignon Blanc.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what we're trying to do. And it's for us now, it's a very small production. It's winery only. We do anywhere from 200 to 400 or 500 cases.
Yeah, that's probably why I haven't had it recently, because you know I'm prodding my memories. And when was the last time I had a Sanford Sauvignon Blanc? And then now you're explaining.
It's still very successful for us.
Mm-hmm.
It does well in the tasting room, and it's a terrific summertime wine. It's actually barrel fermented, but no new oak. So we're really again looking for the fruit, but we like the palate weight that the barrel fermentation delivers. So it's fun, and I love Sauvignon Blanc. So
now is that it for Sanford? I mean, with the shift in philosophy and the Terlato Group taking over, is there any thought of adding any other grape varieties, for example?
Well, interesting that you asked that, because we actually now do a white Rhone blend. It's called Florida Campo, which mm-hmm. is Spanish for wildflower. And that's a blend of Roussanne and Viognier, again from the Happy Canyon area. And you know, at the moment, it's winery only, but we are planning on distributing a small amount. So that will be interesting to see.
Now, do you own those vineyards? Is this something you're going to be able to perpetuate for a while?
We don't own them, but now the Terlato family, having purchased the Sanford and Benedict vineyard a little over a year ago,
mm-hmm.
There is some Viognier growing there, so that could be an interesting source for that. But it's that wine really is a work in process, and it's
now what's the combination of the blend? Is it more Roussanne? Is it more Viognier?
It's a little more Roussanne. It's about 60-40.
Yeah.
But really, it's something that could vary year by year. They're fermented separately, and then we sit down and do trial blends.
Mm-hmm. No thoughts of doing a Syrah, because I know Santa Barbara County is very, very successful with Syrah.
Well, Doug Fletcher and I have spoken about it, and I think we would really both like to produce one. And I think even in at the Sanford and Benedict Vineyard, there's potential to grow some, but.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of as far as it's gotten, and we feel that there's certainly advantage to focusing on Chardonnay and Pinot Noir, which is what we know we can do well.
Yeah, I know it's what you're famous for.
Well, and then what we're doing, in terms of sort of new things, is we're actually doing some block designates, just from very, very small sections of the vineyard
mm-hmm.
that are making some really interesting and diverse, distinctive wines.
I can't wait to try some of those. Steve Fennell, we are out of time. I want to thank you for joining me today. And, it looks like you're very happy with the move down south from the Napa Valley. And I wish you continued success at Sanford Winery.
Thank you very much, Robert.
Okay. That's all we have time for this week. This is Robert Whitley for Whitley on Wine saying ciao.
Slow.